Support for WPR comes from Focus on Energy, committed to helping Wisconsinites focus on the planet by making smart energy choices. Energy resources for Earth Day and every day can be found at focusonenergy.com.
Hi, I'm Anne Strainchamps. And I want to take you back to a time when the world was filled with eldritch, alien gods and monsters. Terrifying deities with tentacles and fangs, claws and scales and feelers. Welcome to the world of H.P. Lovecraft, the writer who invented a universe of unspeakable cosmic horror. He inspired movies like Aliens and Ghostbusters. He's revered by writers like Stephen King and Joyce Carol Oates. His influence has even spread billions of miles into outer space, because part of Pluto is named for his most famous monster, Cthulhu. Today, on To the Best of Our Knowledge, we're celebrating the 125th anniversary of H.P. Lovecraft, beginning right here with one of his most famous stories, The Call of Cthulhu.
Everyone listened, and everyone was listening still when it lumbered slobberingly into sight and gropingly squeezed its gelatinous green immensity through the black doorway into the tainted outside air of that poison city of madness. Poor Johansson's handwriting almost gave out when he wrote of this. Of the six men who never reached the ship, he thinks two perished of pure fright in that accursed instant. The thing cannot be described. There is no language for such abysms of shrieking and immemorial lunacy, such eldritch contradictions of all matter, force, and cosmic order. A mountain walked or stumbled. God! What wonder that across the earth the great architect went mad and poor Wilcox raved with fever in that telepathic instant. The thing of the idols, the green, sticky spawn of the stars, had awakened to claim its own. The stars were right again, and what an age-old cult had failed to do by design, the band of innocent sailors had done by accident. After vigintillions of years, great Cthulhu was loose again and ravening for delight. Three men were swept up by the flabby claws before anybody turned. God rest them if there be any rest in the universe.
That's Wayne June reading an excerpt from Lovecraft's The Call of Cthulhu. So there's always been a cult following for H.P. Lovecraft stories, but over the past decade or so, that cult has exploded. His work is hugely popular now. It's influenced dozens of writers and directors. But why? Eric Davis is a cultural critic and the author of his own cult classic, a book called Technosis: Myth, Magic, and Mysticism in the Age of Information. And he fell under Lovecraft's spell as a teenager.
In a way, Lovecraft charted a path between some of the appeal of the old Gothic supernatural tale and then increasingly a very modern form of horror, which still had the sort of cosmic resonances of those older forms, but now stripped of their kind of Victorian claptrap and brought into a more urgent and even sort of journalistic world. So there's a quality of realism to the stories, almost a sense as if you're entering a kind of liminal zone where it's not really clear what's true or what's not true. And this is something that the characters in the stories are undergoing themselves as they read forbidden literature, as they discover strange synchronicities that all point to some unhallowed secret that we as readers can kind of glimpse usually before the protagonists do. But in many ways, it's a process of building a story more like a detective story, let's say, than a classic ghost tale. Mm. And there's something about the way the books draw you into their sort of fantasized reality that make them quite intoxicating, certainly for the adolescent me, but I think that's partly what the current craze is, or the sort of abiding craze is there's a way in which Lovecraft is inviting us all to play a game in which his world is more real than most fictions can achieve.
So let's talk a bit about H.P. Lovecraft himself. He was born in Providence, Rhode Island in 1890. What was his childhood like?
He simultaneously was a pampered child who was doted upon and came from money. And yet the family was a deeply disturbing situation for him, his father dying of most likely syphilis and his mother essentially going mad. And he's raised by his aunts in progressively more degraded circumstances. So he goes from a privileged childhood to abject poverty through most of his life. So these things all certainly played a role, and people of a psychoanalytic bent might point toward the physical ravages of syphilis as a possible source for his ghoulish tentacled monsters and such. But it's certainly the case that he had a peculiar childhood, and one in which he sort of responded to by becoming a bookish person himself, but more particularly rooting himself in the past. And that's part of what's interesting about Lovecraft is, on the one hand, he was very much a man of his time intellectually. He accepted the model of science. He accepted that we were on a meaningless ball of dirt hurtling through the outer vortices of the cosmos, and that all of the old fairy stories of Christianity and religion were all bunkum. And he was sort of lived in the face of that kind of existential condition. And yet, at the same time, he was a deeply conservative man, aesthetically, probably more than anything. He loved the history of New England. He loved Georgian architecture. And indeed, in his fiction, you see a sort of nostalgia and a real sensitivity to these earlier eras when he thought humans just figured out a better way to be in the midst of a world that was ultimately a meaningless chaos.
You've painted a picture of a man who was very rational, very materialist, educated in our modern scientific language, and yet who wrote and created a whole kind of mythological world, which he sourced partly from dreams, and that was very much about the unknown and the existence of another side of reality. Were those two things at war in him?
That's a good question, but I think not. And I think that actually it's the way they weren't at war with each other that partly explains his enduring appeal. And this is what I mean by that. If you really fully inhabit that modern scientific materialist view, you can't really ascribe any purpose or meaning to human life, to the planet's existence, to existence in any sense. I think that it leads towards a kind of cosmic or metaphysical pessimism about ultimate values, ultimate meanings, ultimate purpose. And these monsters, or these entities, though they have a kind of mythological or supernatural air to them, and they weave their stories into the ancient stories of the past and savage rites and old magics, they are not really part of that supernatural mythological world. They're really science fiction creatures in the sense that they're in a rationalist scientific world. And so in some ways, their alien character, their amoral character, their impossible to understand character, not so much evil as just outside us, completely without any care for us, that in some ways they embody that very quality of the materialist universe, of a sort of meaningless cosmos that just spins through and cares nothing for our little human stories and hopes and fears.
Are you saying that the horror he channeled was the horror of living in our modern world?
To some degree, yes. I think that to live in a world where morals and purpose and meanings are such fragile things in the hard light of a certain way of approaching science, which isn't the way that all scientists think by any means, but is the way that many people, particularly in the 20th century, came to think through them when we think about existentialism, when we think about the sort of aesthetics of the absurd, or even Dada and things like that. Lovecraft was seeing something similar and instead chose to sort of tell horror stories that played with the edge of that kind of pessimistic cosmos.
It's been 125 years since Lovecraft was born. Why do you think we're still talking about him?
Well, I think that the game he started to play, the Cthulhu mythos, let's call it, is a very, very infectious game. And like Star Trek, like, you know, World of Warcraft, there's something very fun about playing a sort of imaginative game that scales, that goes through the generations, that has more and more layers of reference to it. So once it gets going, it has a really powerful inertial quality. That said, it's still pretty remarkable how long it's been going. And so part of the answer is just things that people have done with it. So making this wonderful role-playing game, Call of Cthulhu, which then spins off into other kinds of games so that gamers sort of play with it. I mean, he's really sort of the godfather of horror. All horror writers are going to have their take on Lovecraft or their way of referring to Lovecraft in a way that very few other horror writers have. And finally, I just think there's something particularly appealing about these gods precisely because they are a modern mythology, that they speak to a particular junction when fantasy became science fiction, to talk about literary genres, but also when the kind of supernatural world that fed us with some kind of vision of a broader, more mysterious universe, when that sort of gothic imagination became something else, or tried to find itself again in the new, perhaps bleaker, but still remarkable landscapes of the science-infused imagination of the 20th century. And our cosmology is completely bizarre now. I mean, it's just from astrophysics to the size of the universe. I mean, it's just absurd and amazing how bizarre the world that we live in is, even compared to 100 years ago in terms of the model of the universe. And there's something about that resonance that really works with Lovecraft stories, even if they're taking place in these very kind of dated environments.
Sounds like if we hadn't discovered black holes, Lovecraft would have invented them.
Indeed. And there's something living inside them, too.
Stop.
See, it's infectious.
Thanks, Eric.
All right.
Eric Davis is the author of the essay Calling Cthulhu, H.P. Lovecraft's Magical Realism. And that's magical with a K. So if you haven't read Lovecraft, it can be hard to explain exactly how he makes his writing so creepy. Media critic Dean Lockwood says actually he does a lot of it with sound.
In Lovecraft stories, there's a lot of attention given to the possibility that our exposure to certain weird things in the world will drive us insane. There's that element of insanity. But I think that Lovecraft is perhaps more interested in our bodily responses to horror, affect. So he talks about the way in which sounds, for example, have a kind of physical impact. He describes sounds that are not really sounds, that are something else. He describes them as sense impacts. So I think rather than sound, Lovecraft is really interested in vibration, in some kind of alien vibration flooding our bodies. He says that we should understand the weird as an attitude of awed listening, as if we were listening for the beating of black wings or some kind of scratching at the edge of the known universe. When we see something, it's as if we master it, we have some kind of protection, we're distant from it. Vision seems to presuppose a certain distance from the phenomenon that we're witnessing. But with sound and this vibratory aspect of sound, it moves through us, it's proximate, it's within us. So you can't stand back from a sonic horror. It floods you, it sweeps through your body. For Lovecraft, the horror is really the cosmos that we find within ourselves. It's the black gulf, the interstellar gulf within humanity. There's something non-human, something alien that's at the heart of our existence. And all of his best stories, I think, are encounters with this otherness, this weirdness within. Part of the experience of reading Lovecraft is to try and get your head around this language, this strange form of expression. And it's not just the individual words or the alien languages that he's invented. It's actually a matter of his style as well. One of the things about Lovecraft is that he has a certain notoriety for being an appalling writer, which I think is probably quite mistaken. I think there's something quite deliberate in the way that his convoluted, contorted style is again a way of introducing a certain kind of alienation into the reading experience. The alien presences, the monsters within Lovecraft, the various entities, one of the things that they tend to have in common is that they inveigle themselves into human communities. They imitate human behavior, human language, and human speech. So in a story such as The Whisper in Darkness, it's precisely about discovering that those around you are imposters and that there's something very wrong with them. This idea of mongrel vibrations, there's something mongrel or mixed about humans, that they have this element of alienness within them, which in Lovecraft often manifests in very disturbing ways. It's well known that he was extremely racist. It could be interpreted, this kind of fear of the alien and this preoccupation with the alien is an inflection of that racist, but it becomes something else, I think. It becomes something more kind of existential, you might say. He is interested in this idea of the strange cosmos in which we find ourselves. That's why I talk about weird ecology. Our lives are entangled with really unsuspected forms of life, ways of being, ways of sensing, new sensations. And one of the ways he figures these new sensations is through imagining a kind of insectile form of life. So insects are his monsters, his creatures. They speak in ways which betray their kinship with insects. So they speak and the language breaks down into a kind of buzzing or rasping, as if they were insects really.
The black ghost of the woods with a thousand tongues.
I mean, that's another interesting aspect of Lovecraft, which is not often remarked upon. He's interested in new technologies, in media, and also in the ways in which they are alienating in their own right. So these technologies are used in order to record and to make our lives easier and more efficient, but they also have their alien aspects as well. So he imagines that a new technology could be invented which plugs us into those weird realms around us, which is a frightening prospect. Often Lovecraft is made sense of in terms of being a kind of response to society and politics around him, the First World War, for example, or changes in capitalism. But also I think one of the things that's rarely remarked upon is that the year that he really starts to write his best-known cosmic horror stories, which is 1926 with Call of Cthulhu, was also the year in which the first national network radio station in America began broadcasting. So the great phase of cosmic horror in Lovecraft's writing coincides with really the inception of commercial radio broadcasting, which he never actually overtly discusses, but it must have had a huge impact upon him. Suddenly these radio sets within the home, the tentacles of commerce creeping into everyday life, a kind of living with this new kind of noise, if you like. I suspect that given Lovecraft's interest in science and technology, was something that filters through into his stories.
Dean Lockwood is a media critic and author of an essay about the ecology of noise in H.P. Lovecraft. It's called Mongrel Vibrations. Coming up, the monstrous side of Lovecraft, his racism. I'm Ann Strangechamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. Everyone seems to have a favorite H.P. Lovecraft story. Philosopher Eugene Thacker likes one called From Beyond, which uses science to speculate about the nature of reality, kind of like philosophy.
It involves this sort of mad scientist type character that creates a strange device. Lovecraft doesn't give it even a very detailed description of what this device is, but supposedly it enables a person to see what normally we cannot see, even into other dimensions. And Lovecraft here is very much influenced by quantum physics and relativity and stuff, which he was very interested in. As with many of Lovecraft's stories, what happens is that invariably the character goes mad. He goes crazy because it's not something that the human being is built for, that kind of reception. And there's some great scenes where the character describes seeing these strange quasi-creatures that seem to have bodies, but that they're translucent, and they seem to even pass through him because they're from another dimension or something.
Indescribable shapes, both alive and otherwise, were mixed in disgusting disarray, and close to every known thing were whole worlds of alien unknown entities. It likewise seemed that all the known things entered into the composition of other unknown things, and vice versa. Foremost among the living objects were great inky jellyish monstrosities which flabbily quivered in harmony with the vibrations from the machine. They were present in loathsome profusion, and I saw to my horror that they overlapped, that they were semi-fluid and capable of passing through one another and through what we know as solids. These things were never still, but seemed ever floating about with some malignant purpose. Sometimes they appeared to devour one another, the attacker launching itself at its victim and instantaneously obliterating the latter from sight. Shudderingly, I felt that I knew what had obliterated the unfortunate servants, and could not exclude the things from my mind as I strove to observe other properties of the newly visible world that lies unseen around us.
Philosopher Eugene Thacker recommends the story From Beyond, dramatized by the H.P. Lovecraft Literary Podcast. Yes, there really is one, called H.P. Podcraft. So H.P. Lovecraft may have been a great writer, but he was also undeniably a racist, which pretty much ruins him for a lot of readers and writers. In fact, there's currently a petition in front of the World Fantasy Award protesting the organization's award statue, which they give out every year. It's a bust of H.P. Lovecraft. Over 2,000 writers are demanding that be replaced, ideally with a statue honoring Octavia Butler, the late African-American science fiction writer. One of the people who has a problem reading Lovecraft because of his racism is Gemma Files. She's a Canadian horror writer, and Steve Paulson caught up with her.
Gemma, are you a fan of H.P. Lovecraft's work?
I'm more a fan of the works that Lovecraft's work has inspired than I am of Lovecraft himself. He has problems above and beyond the obvious. I mean, he never met a piece of exposition he didn't like. He can't write dialogue at all. He nests his narratives so intensely that half the time you have difficulty remembering who's telling you what, about what happened, and when and to who. His language is really exclusionary, even when he's just describing things and he's a total snob. And then, of course, there's the racism.
Okay, so what do you like about his influence then?
I really like the mythology that he came up with. I really like the idea of an overwhelming universe crushing down on humanity. I mean, I don't like it, but it's very powerful, and it appeals to me on a very specific human level. I think that Lovecraft, at his best, reaches a point of existential dread that all of us understand and all of us can sympathize with.
Yeah. Let me pursue some of the problems that you mentioned having to do with Lovecraft. Now, he was notoriously racist. There's one letter, for instance, where he described New York's Chinatown as, quote, a bastard mess of stewing mongrel flesh.
That's the one.
As a horror writer and as someone who considers Lovecraft an influence, how do you reconcile his racism with his work?
I can't reconcile his racism any more than I could ever ask or expect anyone else to reconcile it. I mean, you could point out that Lovecraft came from an incredibly inbred family, that he had physical issues, which meant he was in pain a lot of the time, and most of his hatred of the people he characterized as barely human was actually fear. But then you sound like you're making excuses. He was a grown-ass man when he said these horrible things. And if he was around today, I'd tell him to own them and that they were utterly unacceptable and that he needs to do some hard thinking about his life and his choices. Unfortunately, we can't do any of that because he's dead.
Yeah.
But what we can do, what I and my friends have already done, is commit to refuting Lovecraft through our Lovecraftiana, to being inclusive and diverse and making our true monsters the human beings who want to treat other human beings like they aren't.
And you've written a short story that appears in a new anthology of Lovecraft-inspired fiction called She Walks in Shadows. And the stories are all about women and all written by women. Your story is called Hair Work. Tell me about that.
Basically, what I did was I took a story called Medusa's Coil, which Lovecraft co-wrote with a woman named Zealia Bishop for Weird Tales. And the thing about Medusa's Coil is that it is, of all the racist stuff that Lovecraft ever wrote, it is one of the most overtly racist. It concludes with what really has to be one of the most racist lines that Lovecraft ever committed to paper, and that's really saying a lot, which basically is that by the end of that story, the main character is like, well, we examined this woman's body after death, and we found out that in deceitfully slight proportion, Marceline was a negress. And he says it as though that's worse than the fact that she was also a sorceress whose hair detached from her head and went around strangling people by itself like some enormous hair spider.
Sort of like Medusa. Yeah, I mean, exactly like Medusa.
Yeah, exactly like Medusa. So when Silvio Moreno-Garcia approached me to be part of She Walks in Shadows, her idea was that we should take actual Lovecraftian texts and spin them, and to some degree take female monsters and redeem them and make them the central characters. And I was like, yeah, okay, Medusa's Coil. I want to do that with Marceline Bedard de Russy. What I like about it is that in the story, Marceline is already dead. She has no voice, literally. She is just this predatory, alien, subhuman monster that some poor dude married and brought over from France, and oh, everything just fell to crap after that. And what people kind of gloss over is the fact that Marceline is fairly obviously biracial. I think it's entirely likely that she might actually be related to the de Russys. And the de Russys live on a plantation where they were once huge slave owners. They don't have any slaves anymore because, unfortunately, that pleasant institution has been discontinued. I swear to God, pleasant institution. I have a copy which I got secondhand, and somebody has underlined that line and written in the margin, pleasant? Question mark, question mark, question mark.
So those were Lovecraft. That was Lovecraft's phrase.
That was Lovecraft,
pleasant,
yeah.
Pleasant institution.
Yeah, it's that kind of story. You know, Lovecraft is like, oh, these poor, sad, noble former slave owners, you know, preyed upon by the dregs of humanity. And I'm like, man, I want to take that and do the 12 years a slave version where you come out the back of it and you're like, the de Russys deserved everything they got.
Well, let's hear a bit from that story. And I know you've brought along a copy of it, and we've picked out a passage. Do you need to set up this passage at all?
This is about the first time that Marceline, who is the narrator, meets the man who is going to become her husband and who is her cousin. A morning sampler, embroidered in 15 different de Russy family members' hair, once hung upstairs, just outside my husband's childhood bedroom door. Such a pretty garden scene at first glance, soft and gracious, depicting the linden tree border separating river and dock from well-manicured green lawn and edging flower beds, that useless clutter of exotic blooms, completely unsuited to local climate or soil, which routinely drank up half the fresh water diverted from the slave quarter's meager vegetable patch. The lindens also performed a second function, of course, making sure de Russy eyes were never knowingly forced to contemplate what their negros called the bone field, a wet clay sump where the slaves' corpses were buried at night and without ceremony once their squeamish masters were safely asleep. Landscaping as maquillage, a false face overwrought, the skull, skin hid. But then we all look the same underneath, no matter our outward shade, n'est-ce pas? In 1912, I took Dennis's hand at a Paris soiree and knew him immediately from my own blood, from the way the very touch of him made my skin crawl. that oh-so-desirable peau si blanche, olive-inflected like old ivory, light enough to shine under candle flame. I had my tannet wig on that night. Coils of it hung down in tiers as far as my hips, my thighs, far enough to brush the very backs of my bare knees. I'd been rehearsing most of the day, preparing to chant the old rites in Shona while doing what my posters called a Rudma stance for fools with deep pockets. Frank Marsh was there too, of course. His fishy eyes hung out on strings. He introduced Dennis to me, then pulled me aside and begged me once again to allow him to paint me as the gods intended, with only my ancestors' hair from modesty. But I laughed in his face and turned back to Dennis instead, for here was the touch of true fate at last, culmination of my mother's many prayers and sacrifices, mine to bend myself to him and bind him fast, make him bring me back to Riverside to do what must be done, just as it had been Frank's unwitting destiny to make that introduction all along and suffer the consequences. Antoine de Russy liked to boast he kept Dennis unworldly, and I must suppose it to be so, for he never saw me with my wig off, my tannet locks set by, and the not-so-soft fuzz of black which anchored it on display. As he was raised to think himself a gentleman, it would never have occurred to Dennis to demand such intimacies. By the time his father pressed him to do so, I had him well-trained. Something odd about that woman, boy, I heard him whisper more than once before they fell out. Makes my blood run cold to see it. For all she's foreign-born, I'd almost swear I know her face. Ha! As though the man had no memory or no mirrors. Yet I was far too fair for the one, I suspect, and far too different, though in deceitfully slight proportion, to quote that northerner who wrote your vaunted testimony, for the other, it being difficult to acknowledge your own features in so alien a mirror, not even when they come echoing back to you over generations of mixed blood, let alone on your only son's arm.
Oh, that is great. Thank you. So the idea of black women's hair looms large in your story. And of course, black hair is an important part of black history. Can you talk about how you used that in your story?
The hair, Marceline's tannet Isis wig, is her most powerful magical tool, and it definitely preserves her intelligence after death. It's made out of the hair of her ancestors, symbolizing the revenge of generation of slaves, tormented and killed on the de Russy plantation, especially the ones like Marceline's mother, who essentially are de Russys because they were forced to have sex with and bear children by de Russy men. And part of Marceline's deceptiveness in Lovecraft's eyes is that you can't just look at her and recognize that she has African blood. A key portion of that probably comes from the wig, this very long white-looking pile of hair that's not rough enough to necessarily read as black. And the idea of having good hair is a really old one in African-American culture. Chris Rock did a whole documentary about it. It's an intersectional issue. It's a standard of beauty by which women inside the community feel policed by popular culture, but also one that people inside the community use to police each other, especially when they're biracial, like Marceline. So the wig is a symbol of what they call misogynoir, but also of the capitalist issue that there's an entire multi-million-dollar industry built around encouraging black women to hate the way their hair looks naturally. And most recently, we've seen this called out on TV shows like How to Get Away with Murder, on which Viola Davis made people very uncomfortable by taking her wig off in front of the camera as a sign of vulnerability, and Empire, where the main characters are always criticizing each other's weaves.
Yeah. Well, I mean, one of the things that you're dealing with here is you're sort of playing with this notion of miscegenation. I mean, the mixing of different races, which runs throughout Lovecraft's work. And I mean, of course, he was horrified by it. And this is very prominent in your story as well. But you're taking quite a different approach. I mean, you're not using this in a racist way at all.
I like to hope I'm not doing that. The fact is that, you know, I was born in England and I was raised in Canada, and I am as white as a sack of sheets. And I have to cop to that. If somebody says me writing in Marceline's voice is cultural appropriation, all I can ever say is, well, yes, you're right.
Do you have to think twice about that? I mean, you being a white woman writing in a black voice?
What I try to do is to own it and say, these are the choices that I'm making. And I try to open myself up and try to make sure that when I write a character like Marceline, I'm not making her say things. I am, to some degree, and this sounds ridiculous, it sounds kind of, you know, spooky, like, oh, I open myself up and the muses come into me. But, you know, opening myself up and letting her speak for herself.
No, I would think another approach would have been just to write the story, but just to forget about Lovecraft. I mean, why refer back to him? Why try to invert the Lovecraft racism and to turn it into a different kind of story where the politics work? Why not just forget about Lovecraft?
A lot of people say that. A lot of people are sort of like, well, Lovecraft was a sad old white man. Throw him away. Throw him away with the trash. And the problem is that the tendrils of Lovecraft's influence are really everywhere in not just old school horror, but modern horror as well. The things that he came up with have infiltrated every level of horror as it exists. And I think in much the same way that you should not allow people to write school books that call slaves immigrants or migrant workers, you know? People came from all over the world to work in America. Well, yeah, because they were sold here. The hell, you know? I mean, in the same way that you shouldn't be allowed to do that, you should not be allowed to forget who Lovecraft was in both senses of the word, that he was a guy whose imagination was amazing in some ways. I cling to the idea that horror is not a niche market. Horror is, in fact, something that is very basic and very understandable for everyone. A lot of people don't want to think about the things that horror faces all the time, but they are utterly bedrock human things like mortality and loss and sorrow and rage and hatred. And that's at the heart of Lovecraft. It's basic human stuff. And when we reject Lovecraft and say, throw him on the trash heap, we don't have to deal with him anymore, we reject the fact that part of our own composition is the urge to look at other people and say, I'm human and you're not. I'm a real person and you're not.
Gemma Files is an award-winning Canadian horror writer. Her work is featured in a new anthology called She Walks in Shadows. Women Writers Reimagine Lovecraft's Mythos. Steve Paulson talked with her. Coming up, weird fiction writer Jeff Vandebeert talks about how to move beyond H.P. Lovecraft, and he recommends a writer who can help. I'm Anne Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. Think it's too soon to get your kids hooked on the cosmic horror of H.P. Lovecraft? Think again. Even the little ones might enjoy The Call of Cthulhu for Beginning Readers by a guy who calls himself Dr. Faustus A.U. Here's an excerpt.
When the sailors then learned that Cthulhu could swim, poor old Brighton went mad and the future looked grim. The alert started moving, but not very fast. And the creature drew closer each moment that passed. There was nothing to do but to steer with the wheel, till Cthulhu's great head was lined up with the keel. When the yacht pierced Cthulhu between his great eyes, the alert had survived. To Johansson's surprise. At the end of the logbook, I fearfully read that the monster was sighted repairing his head. By the time they were rescued, poor Bryden had died, and Johansson was sitting with eyes open wide. Then the rescue ship Vigilant sailed past the spot where the city once was, but by then, was not. I assume that Cthulhu resumed his great sleep at the heart of his city, way down in the deep.
An excerpt from The Call of Cthulhu for Beginning Readers. It's by Richard Ivankovich, alias Dr. Faustus A.U. Some contemporary horror writers are happy to acknowledge H.P. Lovecraft's influence on their work, but not all of them. Jeff Vandermeer is one of the stars of a relatively new literary genre called weird fiction. He wrote the Southern Reach trilogy. It's a horror series set in a kind of mutant southern wilderness. Vandermeer talked with Doug Gordon about why weird fiction writers should move beyond Lovecraft.
Jeff, can you take me back to the first time you read an H.P. Lovecraft story?
Sorry, I'm laughing because Lovecraft for a long time was this kind of shiny rock, you know, that looked interesting that I was supposed to like, but that I could never really find an entry point into. And so there are some of the images in his work that are very evocative, but I didn't actually read Lovecraft that early on. I kept bouncing off of him and going on to other things like Kafka and other writers like that I felt more attuned to. I do remember I read The Strange Case of Dexter Ward, which I liked because it had a structure similar to some of the work of Nabokov, you know, almost a little bit metafictional.
Yeah.
But I hadn't actually read a lot of his work early on.
I've read that when you first encountered him, a quote from you was that you were bored silly. Is that fair to say?
Pretty much. But, you know, I also come at this stuff from having a real kind of naturalist view of the world in terms of the environment and everything. And so I would read something like The Mountains of Madness, and all I could see is that these giant penguins made no sense whatsoever. So I probably wasn't cutting him enough slack. But it does make a point, which is to say there's stuff in there that's not from the real world that, if you have an experience of something from the real world, doesn't necessarily ring true. And I always thought in my own fiction that I wanted to make sure that it was really based in my own personal experience, and then the uncanny elements would come naturally out of that. So that may be why I kind of bounce off of Lovecraft a little bit. Also, he doesn't seem to like nature very much. or other people.
Yeah. Correct me if I'm wrong. I'm getting the sense you're saying that the whole Cthulhu mythos is just too artificial and too out there.
This may be a terrible thing to say, but it reads like really good instructions for a role-playing game to me.
Which, of course, it's become, yeah.
On the other hand, writers that I really love, right. Laird Barron, Chana Mieville, Caitlin R. Kiernan, have cooked Lovecraft, so to speak. And he's clearly an influence.
So Lovecraft hasn't been an influence on your fiction at all. Would that be fair to say?
It hasn't, and yet I understand why it's a shorthand. You know, he's the one that made it into the pop culture kind of canon. That's really what it is, not so much even the literary canon, but the pop culture canon. And so I see the value of it to some writers, and I certainly don't think that's necessarily a bad thing when it's cooked, because, you know, he did have his issues, as we all know. But I feel like there just needs to be more of a going beyond Lovecraft in terms of other writers.
Isn't it fair to say, though, a lot of people have the impression that you're somewhat influenced by Lovecraft?
Yeah.
Why do you think it is?
Well, I'll tell you exactly why it is. First of all, it is this shorthand for weird fiction. And also, quite frankly, you know, I come to fiction through study of weird science, you know, weird biology, all the stuff about fungus in my stories, all the stuff about squid. And then in this latest series, you know, all of the natural observations of the world is stuff where I'm extrapolating from studying the biology. You know, my dad's a research chemist. My mom was a biological illustrator for a time. And so I really come at it from that aspect, that the real world is more alien than we think.
Yeah.
And that's really fascinating. And so it's almost like you can see the parallels, but they're working at different directions, because I'm very much about, we need to change our relationship with nature. And Lovecraft is kind of like, I hate nature. Right? So that's a pretty fundamental difference as far as I'm concerned.
For sure. When you won your first World Fantasy Award, it was for a novella called The Transformation of Martin Lake. Mm-hmm. And the award you received was a bust of Lovecraft. So I'm guessing, obviously, in light of what you've been saying, that didn't have any special significance for you, did it?
Well, it's funny because I didn't even think about it. It's kind of a caricature, and so I thought it was a bust of an ugly ghost that Gut Gahan Wilson had done. And it wasn't until after that I realized what it was. And that actually got me in trouble, because my boss at my day job, it was shipped there, saw this, realized I was a writer, and suddenly I was writing a novel about the company for him. So
we've reached peak Lovecraft. He looms too large, and, you know, it's like peak oil. Now we've got peak Lovecraft. So why do you see Lovecraft's large literary influence as such a problem?
Well, I mean, think of it this way. What if there were a cult that doesn't believe you when you tell them that you're not secretly part of it too, and keeps insisting, and doesn't allow you to talk about the things that are actually important to you? And that happens to a lot of weird writers across the board in terms of weird fiction and people who are influenced by Kafka even. Or if someone kept insisting that everyone who writes mainstream literary fiction was influenced primarily by Faulkner and must be defined by Faulkner for all time.
Yeah, we lose a lot of diversity, and we miss out on other approaches to story and to character.
Am I trying to erase Lovecraft from the canon? No, I'm simply trying to add to what's out there and talk about things other than Lovecraft.
Yeah, and one of the writers who can help us move past H.P. Lovecraft is a guy who's been described as the best-kept secret in contemporary horror fiction, Thomas Ligotti. Penguin Classics has just reissued his first two short story collections as one title, and you actually wrote the foreword to this book. Is it fair to say that Ligotti has been influenced by Lovecraft at all?
I think very early on, and of course, he has one story that's dedicated to Lovecraft in this Penguin Classics reissue. And I specifically asked him about this before this interview, and his position is simply that Lovecraft's fiction had made Ligotti aware of the fact that he could have a career as a writer. Mm-hmm. And so very early on, he encountered Lovecraft as kind of an entry point to, I guess you could call it book culture and the idea of being a writer. And then moved on to all these other things. I mean, he has an encyclopedic knowledge, Ligotti does, of European, Eastern European literature. And, you know, even Thomas Bernhard and people like that are reflected in his work.
Yeah, and as you mentioned, the Ligotti story that is in this new volume that you wrote the introduction for, the story that is very Lovecraftian and is actually dedicated to Lovecraft, is The Last Feast of Harlequin. Can you tell me about this story?
Well, it's funny because he may dedicate it to Lovecraft, but I didn't really make that much of an association with it. What I liked about it is it's an anthropologist who visits this town of, I guess you pronounce it, Miracaw, out of curiosity about a clown festival, and then the terrible things that happen as a result. And the thing that's so funny about the story is the kind of deadpan seriousness of the anthropologist set against the absurdity of what he views. And this is pretty crucial to what Ligotti does. I don't think Lovecraft really expresses a sense of humor in his work that much, but Ligotti often has a very dark but very funny sense of humor that comes out in terms of the absurdity, kind of like when you see humor peeking out from Kafka's work. So that's what distinguishes him in the weird in general, in that he's very funny. Once you kind of acclimate yourself to the grotesque elements in Ligotti's work, you can then experience and really enjoy the humor.
Yeah.
And so it's really quite a fun story because he just keeps spinning it out and spinning it out, and ever more outrageous things, you know, kind of happen in the story.
Could I ask you to read a passage from it?
Sure.
And maybe set it up for us a bit?
Yes. Well, this is really kind of, I think, in the heart of it, in that he's now encountering the clowns in the town and this festival, and he's having kind of a interaction or conversation with them. And it's not really going quite the way that he would have expected, and he's getting a little more involved than he would have thought. So I was mingling with the crowd on the street, warmly enjoying the confusion around me, when I saw a strangely designed creature lingering on the corner up ahead. It was one of the clowns. Its clothes were shabby and nondescript, almost in the style of a tramp-type clown, but not humorously exaggerated enough. The face, though, made up for the lackluster costume. I had never seen such a strange conception for a clown's countenance. The figure stood beneath a dim streetlight, and when it turned its head my way, I felt a sense of recognition. The thin, smooth, and pale head, the wide eyes, the oval-shaped features, resembling nothing so much as the skull-faced screaming creature in that famous painting, Memory Fails Me. This clownish imitation rivaled the original in summoning an effect of stricken horror and despair. It had an inhuman likeness more proper to something under the earth than upon it. From the first moment I saw this creature, I thought of those inhabitants down the hill. There was the same nauseating passivity and languor in its bearing. Perhaps if I had not been drinking earlier, I would not have been bold enough to take the action I did. I decided to join in one of the upstanding traditions of the winter festival, for it annoyed me to see this morbid imposter of a clown standing up. When I reached the corner, I laughingly pushed myself into the creature, who stumbled backward and ended up on the sidewalk. I laughed again and looked around for approval from my fellow merrymakers in the vicinity. No one, however, seemed to appreciate or even acknowledge what I had done. They did not laugh with me or point with amusement, but only passed by, perhaps walking a little faster, until they were some distance from the street corner incident. I realized instantly I had violated some tacit rule of behavior, though I had thought my action well within the common practice. The idea occurred to me that I might even be apprehended and persecuted for what in any other circumstances was certainly a criminal act. I turned around to help the clown back to his feet, hoping to somehow redeem my offense, but the creature was gone. Solemnly, I walked away from the scene of my inadvertent crime and sought other streets away from its witnesses.
That was great. Thank you, Jeff. One thing that strikes me about Ligotti's stories is how much he writes about the architecture of his story worlds. He really immerses you in the settings, doesn't he? Often, especially in the opening paragraphs, he'll start with the architecture and it'll take a while before he'll introduce any characters.
Yeah. The thing about Ligotti is he's one of those writers who colonizes your brain. So sometimes you'll start his fiction and there may be a certain slowness to it because of the approach he takes, but there's a hypnotic quality too. And once you get used to the rhythm of some of those stories, I mean, some of them are just immediate right off the bat, but those other ones, they are some of his best in a way because they immerse you. They kind of seduce you in a way where you really do go to another world. And I think that that is part of his approach, that he's willing to have a different kind of pacing and then you adjust to it. And that's when it becomes really enjoyable.
Is there something special, something unique about the way Ligotti uses the supernatural in his fiction?
Well, I find him fairly unique in that he is very dry and intellectual at the same time that he is visceral and gets under your skin. And it's very unique to find a writer who can do those things, a writer who has that kind of cold surface at times, which can be very chilling and interesting. But then there's this kind of passionate beating heart underneath it, or the sense of humor or something else. It's very layered fiction, and that speaks to the wide range of influences.
Jeff Vandermeer is the author of the Southern Reach trilogy. He also wrote the foreword to the New Penguin Classics edition of Songs of a Dead Dreamer and Grimscribe by Thomas Ligotti. Doug Gordon talked with him. So I'm curious, do you guys like H.P. Lovecraft? Have you read him? Let us know what you think by posting on our Facebook page. Before we go, I've got a quick announcement. We're taking, to the best of our knowledge, On the Road for the first time. We'll be on stage in Salt Lake City November 2nd, so if you're nearby, come see us. You'll find information on our website at ttbook.org. The Best of Our Knowledge comes to you from Wisconsin Public Radio. Doug Gordon produced today's show, with help from Charles Monroe Kane, Raymond Tungekar, and Craig Ely. Our theme music is by Steve Mullen from Walk West Music. Kirill Owen is our technical director. Steve Paulson is our executive producer. And I'm Ann Strainchamps. Thanks for listening.
PRI, Public Radio International.